content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. We'll begin today's program with an article from the July and August 2018 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, titled The American Crusade by Dan Jones, and it's part of the prologue section of Smithsonian. Disbanded 7 centuries ago, the most famous of the medieval Christian orders is fighting for new conquests. Joseph A. Autery raises his sword and brings it down through a layer of yellow icing, cutting a large birthday cake in half. A couple of hundred people cheer. The crowd is mostly dressed in business attire, but Autery is wearing medieval-style armor, a shirt of steel-link mail, a mail coif on his head, plate armor on his shoulders, and white linen robes emblazoned with a red cross. The outfit weighs 65 pounds and can cause problems for airline baggage handlers. His sword, modeled on one from the Ridley Scott movie Kingdom of Heaven, is not battle-sharp, but it cuts sponge cake easily enough. By day, Joe Autery, 49, is a partner in a financial planning company based in Pennsylvania. This evening, though, he is Hugh de Payns, a French knight who died in 1136 after establishing a military order known as the Knights Templar. It is Memorial Day weekend, and we are in a hotel in Nashville, Tennessee, where about 350 members of the Autonomous Sovereign Military Order of the Temple of Jerusalem have gathered to mark the 900th birthday of the Knights Templar. Members of the charitable organization, known by the unwieldy abbreviation SMOTJ, regard themselves as spiritual descendants of the original Templars. It's a historical legacy many groups vie for, and in that regard, the SMOTJ's celebration is off to an inauspicious start. Most scholars date the foundation of the first Templars to 1119 or 1120, making the order today just 898 or 899 years old. No matter, the assembled are eager to get the party started, and the cake cutting kicks off a weekend that will culminate in the dubbing of 7 new knights and dames, and a ritual the official literature says will prepare you for the great works you have yet to complete. The original Knights Templar, shorthand for the Order of the Poor Knights of the Temple of Jerusalem, were founded to protect Christian pilgrims on the roads of Palestine following the First Crusade. The group was named for its original headquarters on the Temple Mount. Members were often called quote-unquote warrior monks, since they fought on the front line of the Crusades and swore oaths of chastity, poverty, and obedience. In their day, though, the Templar organization was rich. It owned property stretching from Britain to Syria, profits from which were used to fund military expeditions in the Holy Land and charitable deeds across the West. The order boasted considerable financial acumen, providing international banking and credit transfer services. It counted the Pope and Kings of France among its clients. Its knights were also renowned for bravery in battle. One Muslim writer called them, quote, the fiercest fighters, end quote, of all the Crusaders. However, beginning on Friday the 13th of October, 1307, the Templars were destroyed in a process instigated by the French King Philip IV, the Fair, and abetted by Pope Clement V. The Templars had been tainted by the final failure of the Crusades in 1291. They were also victims of the French king's chronic shortage of money. Templar brothers across Europe were arrested, charged with crimes including sodomy, blasphemy, and worshipping false idols. They were imprisoned, tortured, and forced to make false confessions. In March 1312, a church council formally abolished the order. Its property was confiscated and its members stripped of their rank. In 1314, the last master, Jacques de Molay, was burned at the stake in Paris. That grisly demise has lent the Templars lasting notoriety and a thick shrouding of myth. They crop up regularly in modern entertainment, most famously in Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, which casts them as the shadowy guardians of ancient religious secrets, and more recently in the video game franchise Assassin's Creed, which transforms them into time-traveling supervillains. The Templars have also been widely revived and imitated for purposes both benign and sinister since at least 1737, when the Scottish Freemason Andrew Michael Ramsay wrote a pseudo-history of Masonry that claimed ties to the medieval Templars. Today, Templar revivalism remains strong. Templar iconography is popular with European neo-fascists. The Norwegian mass murderer Anders Breivik claimed to be a Templar, and Knights Templar International is an online network that connects far-right activists, particularly in Britain. In Mexico, a drug cartel called Los Caballeros Templarios has borrowed from Templar symbolism to create its own brand and code of honor. Templar imitation is enduringly popular, but seldom historically literate. Yet, the Templars I meet in Nashville are mostly fascinated by the history, at times exhaustingly so. They have recently self-published a long, painstakingly footnoted book about Templarism over the centuries. Their internal literature liberally cites medieval texts, such as those of Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, who wrote the original Templars' quasi-monastic rules. For the men and women I encounter, being a 21st century Templar is about far more than medieval cosplay with a donation cup. It is participation in a living metaphor for evangelical Christian advocacy, financial expertise, internationalism, and a militaristic ethos of duty and service to the cause. As Oteri puts it, the only thing we don't do is fight. SMOTJ was founded in the 1960s under the umbrella of an older international network of Templar revivalists called Ordo Supremus Militaris Templi Hieroxylmitiani, which was itself formally recognized by Napoleon Bonaparte in 1805. The worldwide organization claims 5,000 members, 1,500 of whom are the Knights and Dames of the American SMOTJ. They are attached to 33 priories from Arizona to Wisconsin, and many stay in touch via a closed membership smartphone app. The SMOTJ is far from the only Templar revivalist organization in the United States. There is a separate Masonic order and various other non-Masonic groups with online presences. To try to combat confusion, SMOTJ has a legal officer called the Grand Avocat, who works on registering trademarks to guard its brand identity. The main function of the tax-exempt SMOTJ is raising money for Christian causes in the Holy Land, funding schools and scholarships in places like Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Bethany, and Ramla, and sponsoring children through Christian schools. Last year, donations totaled $407,945. My members also sit in an advisory capacity on committees in the United Nations and claim informal involvement in international diplomacy. Some dream of one day having the order restored to papal favor with recognition by the Vatican. There are also perks of membership. It's good networking, with regular opportunities to wear uniforms, accrue titles, and hang out with other like-minded Christians who get a kick from sharing a romantic medieval past. Alteri maintains that there is a seriousness to the dress-up. We are all brought together because of the ideals of a chivalric order, he says. It takes a group of people with a common belief and a common cause to stop the persecution and the exile of Christians. The ongoing head of the organization, the 20th Grand Prior, a smooth-spoken financier named Patrick Michael Carney, justifies it in simpler but more telling terms. We belong to the most prestigious order of knighthood on the planet. The Episcopal Christ Church Cathedral is packed with the seven new inductees, or postulants, take their pews at 3 p.m. on Saturday. The knights and dames who join them wear white mantles with red crosses. Many men wear military formal wear underneath. The Modern Order recruits strongly from the officer classes of the U.S. military. In Nashville, I met several 1- and 2-star generals and many colonels, majors, and captains. A 2-year-old Rottweiler service dog named Teak wears a Templar-themed doggy jacket. There are plenty of women present. In the 1990s, the Order, seeking to maximize membership, forsook medieval rules that argued that the company of women is a dangerous thing. Let not ladies be admitted. One of the postulants is Barbara Prate, a bright, occasionally caustic, 45-year-old nurse from New Jersey. She is dressed for the occasion in a red business suit and high heels. 4 days ago, Barbara and Joe Otteri got married. Between preparing for her own investiture, Barbara had been helping Joe in and out of his Hugh de Payne's outfit. The service takes 3 hours. When the postulants are dubbed, they kneel and Carney taps them on the shoulders with a sword. Another official touches a riding spur to their heels. The night before the ceremony, there had been some discussion as to whether the tradition of kneeling is vital. A couple of the postulants are older. One is an elderly ex-Marine who fought in the Korean War and no longer gets up and down easily. After the dubbings come many awards. I count 27, mostly promotions to various quasi-military orders of merit. There's a ceremonial changing of Grand Prior. The Grand Webmaster is given a Meritorious Service Award. The Grand Archivist gets a medal. A Muslim data analyst and faith leader from New York is inducted into the order and given white robes, presented without a red cross. He is lauded for bringing faith groups together. I wonder if everyone is pleased. Over lunch, one Templar told me, "We don't want any Muslims, because followers of Islam don't respect anybody." His diatribe didn't stop there. Although it is all plainly nonsensical, ambivalence towards Muslims is in tune with Templar history. Many of the original order died fighting Islamic armies, yet the 12th century Syrian writer Usama ibn Munduka praised the Templars for clearing a space in their chapel in Jerusalem so he could pray toward Mecca. Once the service is complete, the Templars shuffle out of church and return to their hotel for a cocktail reception and dinner. During the meal, I feel a hand on my shoulder, and a knight whose name I do not catch leans in and whispers conspiratorially, "We were there." I assume he means the Holy Land, for 160 years, and they tried to kick us out, but we survived. Don't forget, we were God's shock troops. This is pure fantasy, but on balance, the expressions of historicist foolishness and idle prejudice are few compared with accounts of money donated and distributed to schoolchildren in faraway lands, and advocacy for peace through respectable bodies by organizations like the UN. Later, as the night winds down, we stand on a roof terrace overlooking the street outside the hotel. Honky-tonk music drifts up from the bars below. 2 dozen or so Templars, mostly middle-aged guys, are killing beers and whiskey and chomping fat cigars. A couple are talking about St. Bernard of Clairvaux's philosophy. Others are brainstorming ways to raise money for Templar archaeology in Israel. A retired general discusses the possibility of using contacts in the worldwide organization to conduct back-channel diplomacy between the United States and Russia. They are all in earnest and having the time of their lives. I think of something a fellow guest sitting next to me in church said as we sat through the many medal givings and commendations earlier. "There's a lot of bat, beep, crazy here," she murmured. "All of it with good intent." Next, we'll move on to another article in the prologue section titled The Great Divide by Rachel St. John. Today's raging border controversy began with a surprising incident 100 years ago this summer. In early August 1918, Felix B. Penalosa, the Presidente Municipal, or Mayor, of Nogales, Mexico, ordered construction of a fence running along the boundary line between his city and Nogales, Arizona. The fence would consist of 6 wires strung together to a height of 6 feet. His intent was to direct the flow of people crossing the border through two gateways, to make it easier for a growing number of soldiers, customs agents, and other officials to oversee transborder movement. Peñalosa also met with U.S. representatives to discuss a second parallel fence to be built by the Americans. Mexican officials said that they would welcome the building of such a fence by the United States government, as it would aid officials on both sides of the line in enforcing the regulations. And they insisted that such action would not be irritating or offensive to Mexican sentiment. Today, a 10-mile-long rusted steel border wall is a defining feature of the cities. Its origin story begins with these two fences. When they were first erected in Nogales a century ago, they were neither a brazen political statement nor a barrier to immigrants, but a cooperative measure, embraced by both the United States and Mexico, in the spirit of good fences make good neighbors. But the proposed American fence became what was most likely the first permanent barrier to control the movement of people across the U.S.-Mexico border. Peñalosa's fence cut through the heart of the twin cities of Nogales, known as Ambos Nogales, Both Nogales. Founded in 1882, Ambos Nogales became a bustling community centered on the boundary line, which ran along International Street. For years, Mexicans and Americans crossed the border regularly to do business, shop, socialize, and celebrate the holidays of both nations. Years later, former residents recalled how they had even played on the line as children. Tensions along the border started to rise with the Mexican Revolution, which began in 1910, and were heightened by the First World War. A violent battle between opposing Mexican forces took place in Nogales, Mexico in 1913. A second battle in the town 2 years later saw U.S. cavalry men cross into Mexican territory to engage Pancho Villa's troops, who had fired across the line. The wars also fueled worries about smugglers running guns into Mexico, refugees fleeing to the United States, and international espionage in the borderlands. The U.S. government had built its first border fence between 1909 and 1911, a barbed wire divide along the California border, to prevent cattle from wandering between the countries. Now, as both nations adopted new measures to monitor the border, more fences began to appear. Photographs seem to show one besides the Custom House near Tijuana, and another along the border between Douglas, Arizona, and Agua Prieta, Mexico. These were likely temporary wartime measures, and as in Nogales, they were intended to prevent cross-border clashes. But on August 27, 1918, soon after Mexican workers had erected the fence in Nogales, conflict broke out when an unidentified man attempted to cross into Mexico. A U.S. customs inspector ordered him to halt, but he did not stop. Officers on both sides of the border raised their guns, and a firefight broke out. About 2 hours later, at least 12 Mexicans and Americans had been killed, including Peñalosa, who had built the fence precisely to minimize the risk of conflict between the nations. Ironically, despite his failure, U.S. officials in Nogales, Arizona, soon went ahead with plans for their own fence, which quickly became a model for controlling the movement of people across the U.S.-Mexico border. Following Nogales' lead, officials in Calexico, California, erected a fence that ran 2 miles long along the boundary line there. By the 1920s, fences were a fixture in most border towns. Over time, the fences were put to a new use. In the 1940s, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service coordinated with the International Boundary and Water Commission to erect chain-link barriers on the border. More fences, a border patrolman later acknowledged, forced unauthorized migrants through dangerous mountains, deserts, and rivers around the ends of the fence. The U.S. expansion of the fencing in the 1990s doubled down on this strategy, leading to a dramatic increase in the number of migrants who died attempting the treacherous crossing. Thus, the fences and other barriers that stand along much of the U.S.-Mexico border now mark only an international boundary, but also a humanitarian crisis. Now we'll move on to an article in the prologue section under National Treasure, titled Slush Fun by Franz Lids. A Texas restaurant owner blended tequila, ice, and automation. America has been hungover ever since. The way Mariano Martinez tells it, accounts of the margaritas Beginning should be taken with a grain of salt and a wedge of lime. Martinez is the creator of what is arguably the 20th century's most epochal invention, the frozen margarita machine. And at the age of 73, the Dallas restaurateur is an indisputable authority on the cocktail and the salt-rimmed glass. The origin stories date to the 30s and tend to feature a Mexican showgirl or a Texas socialite and a bartender determined to impress her. One of Martinez's favorites involves a teenage dancer named Margarita Carmen Casino, who performed at nightclubs in Tijuana. After Margarita got a contract from a Hollywood studio, she changed her name to Rita Hayworth, he says. Supposedly, the drink was named in her honor. When it comes to margarita lore, about the only thing for certain is that on May 11, 1971, Martinez pulled the lever on a repurposed soft-serve ice cream dispenser and filled a glass with a coil of pale green sherbet, history's first prefab frozen margarita. The beverage was teeth-chatteringly cold with a proper tequila face slap. Happy hour and hangovers would never be the same. By adapting mass production methods to blender drinks, Martinez elevated the frozen margarita from a border cantina curiosity to America's most popular cocktail. The innovation forever changed the Tex-Mex restaurant business, placing bars front and center, and triggered the craze for Tex-Mex food. Benefiting a musician who once recorded three versions of La Bamba on an EP titled La Da Bamba, the convivial Martinez has a fresh, boyish manner and a beaming smile. He grew up in East Dallas, where at age 9 he started bussing tables at El Charro, his father's Mexican eatery. The customers were mostly Anglos, who often had no idea what tequila was, he recalls. They'd show up with a souvenir bottle a friend had brought back from a vacation in Mexico and ask my dad, "What do we do with this?" Though at the time liquor couldn't be sold by the drink in Texas restaurants, the elder Martinez occasionally would whip up frozen margaritas in a blender for his patrons. Introduced at a 1937 restaurant show in Chicago and bankrolled by bandleader Fred Waring, the humble Waring blender revolutionized bar drinks. Elder Martinez used a recipe gleaned while working at a San Antonio speakeasy in 1938. Ice, triple sec, hand-muddled limes, and 100% blue agave tequila. The secret ingredient was a splash of simple syrup. In 1970, an amendment to the state constitution made liquor by the drink legal in cities or counties when approved in local option elections. Shortly after Dallas voted yes, the younger Martinez launched Mariano's Mexican Cuisine in a shopping center near the campus of Southern Methodist University. On opening night, the amiable owner appeared in a bandito costume, and customers, serenaded by a mariachi band, were encouraged to order margaritas made from the old family recipe. Libations were poured faster than you could say one more round. The second night wasn't quite as successful. A barfly cornered Martinez and asked, "Do you know how to make frozen margaritas?" "Oh, sure, sir. It's the best," he answered. "Well, you'd better speak to the bartender. The ones he's making are terrible." As it turned out, the barman was so overwhelmed by the sheer volume of margarita orders that he was tossing ingredients into the blender without measuring them. Tired of slicing limes, he threatened to quit and return to his former job at a Steak and Ale, where the most complicated cocktail was a bourbon and Coke. "I saw my dream evaporating," Martinez says. "I thought my restaurant will go bust, and I've screwed up Dad's formula." The next morning, while making a pit stop at 7-Eleven, Martinez had a eureka moment. "For better consistency, I pre-mix margaritas in a Slurpee machine. All the bartender had to do was open the spigot." But 7-Eleven's parent company refused to sell him the contraption. Besides, Martinez was told, everyone knows alcohol won't freeze. Instead of wasting away in Margaritaville, he bought a second-hand soft-serve ice cream machine and tinkered with Dad's recipes. Diluting the solution with water made the booze too weak, but adding sugar produced a uniform slush. Martinez had struck gold. Cuervo gold, he cracks. The sweet, viscous hooch was such a hit that when Bob Hope performed at SMU in the 70s, he joked about the margarita he just ordered at Mariano's. "I won't say how big it was, but the glass they serve it in had a diving board on it, and they salt the edge of the glass with a paint roller." Martinez's original machine cranked out Ritas for a decade before sputtering to a halt. Though he never received a patent or trademark for the device, it has a place in his heart, and since 2005 in the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. "The credit belongs to heritage and technology," he says. "The golden ratio is two parts of the past and one of the present." We'll move on to another story in the prologue section about an American icon. Full Circle by Alex Scott. A loopy 60-year-old toy comes back around. The women in the black and white videos wear Breton striped shirts, like those favored by Audrey Hepburn, and knee-high socks. Each has a hula hoop, or many of them. They swing them around their waists, but also around their wrists and elbows, shoulders, and knees. A brunette in a bob rotates a hoop around her thighs, then does it while balancing on one leg before climbing the circle up her torso and into the air, a move called the pizza toss. This could be a scene from 1958, the year the United States went dizzy for hula hoops, except for thousands of Instagram followers and the hashtags that accompany the videos. Hashtag hoop, hashtag tricks, hashtag skills. The acrobats are Marawa's majorettes, a troop of hyper hoopers led by Marawa Ibrahim. They performed at the Olympics, set hooping world records, and are among those credited with resurrecting the oh-so-50s phenomenon for the age of social media. The hula hoop was a fad that seemed destined to fade like Pet Rocks, Beanie Babies, and one can hope, fidget spinners. But it celebrates its 60th birthday, the plastic circle is trending. It was Richard Knurr and Arthur Spud Mellon, founders of the Wham-O Toy Company, who transformed a popular Australian toy, the cane hoop, into a space-age craze. They made the ring out of lightweight and inexpensive plastic, trademarked a name that evoked the still exotic territory of Hawaii, its kind of sexy but still family-friendly hula dance, and then launched a marketing campaign that was downright viral. The men took the hoops to Los Angeles parks, demonstrated the trick to kids, and sent a hoop home with everyone who could keep it spinning. Company executives took the hoops on plane trips, hoping fellow passengers would ask about the odd carry-ons. And Wham-O tapped the most powerful new medium of television with hokey, seemingly homemade advertisements. The word spread. The company sold more than 20 million hula hoops in 6 months. Sales never again reached those heights, yet the plastic child's toy has evolved into the years into art, exercise, even a form of meditation. The rhythm of the hooping helps clear the mind, devotees say. It has been adopted by both counterculture, it is a fixture at Burning Man, and digital culture. This summer, a company called VeerFit introduced the V-Hoop, fitted with sensors and a Bluetooth transmitter to monitor a user's every twist and turn via a smartphone app, marrying the quintessential 1950s obsession to the latest fitness tracking fad. The price got an update, too. Wham-O's original hula hoop sold for $1.98. The V-Hoop is a much more modern $119. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.